Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered, how Franny and five other incorrigible cats seized control of our house and made it their home. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles from some newsletters and magazines. We begin today's readings with Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered. In the previous chapter, we learned that Linda and Bob adopted a male cat called Mabel. The male cat yowled and demanded petting all the time, and the other cats did not like him. But eventually, he won the hearts of Bob and Linda, who decided to keep him within their menagerie. Chapter 11, The Anti-Franny. As I complained to Linda about a recent snubbing from Franny, I saw myself writ large in our big baby cat. Even more embarrassing, I started to view all of our cats as feline personifications of my shortcomings. Mooby's incessant wanting, Agnes's crabbiness, and Lucy's sense of entitlement made me feel like the protagonist in a kiddie version of The Pilgrim's Progress, with fresh lessons on how not to live lurking in every litter box. Franny's stubbornness had set me off when I couldn't find her as a storm of biblical proportions rolled in. The Talking Moose weather radio had fibbed that the afternoon would be partly cloudy. When the fully cloudy sky turned a sickly yellow, Linda hurried in from the backyard. I stood in the basement door, hollering for Miss Ferretface. The first blast of wind sent our pair of $4.99 plastic lawn chairs cartwheeling across the lawn. Thunder crackled in the distance, and I popped open the basement door a second time, expecting Franny to shoot inside, but she wasn't there. Galloping out in pursuit of a vinyl patio table, I checked for her behind the wheelbarrow and then stuck my head under the pine boughs where she usually hung out. Our geese honked in apprehension. After checking the perimeter of the house, I ran toward the barn into a sheet of gloom, calling for all the way. Franny! Franny! You're going to get wet! Our neighbor's gravel driveway came alive, spattering me with mud as the waterworks erupted. Leaves tore loose and swirled in the air. Branches clattered above my head. I started toward the river but was driven back by a wind that nearly picked me up and blew me off my feet. At that point, I couldn't have seen or even heard Franny if she had been trotting along at my heels. Linda and I met at the basement door, where we performed an impromptu Three Stooges routine, trying to get into the house at the same time. She had also been shouting for Franny and was even more soaked than I. "I'm worried about her," I said. "Oh, you know cats," she said. "They manage to find shelter somewhere and come out of it after it stops raining, and their hair is as dry as all get out." I glanced down to see Franny lying on a pile of bedding next to my feet on the basement floor next to the refrigerator. She'd never even been outdoors at all. "You heard us calling," I scolded, "over and over and over again. You could have come out and let us know that you were okay." Franny treated me to her innocent kitty blank and didn't stir from her bedding. "Can't we have just one normal cat?" "That is normal for a cat," Linda said. I thought of what Bill Holm had told me the last time I groused to him about how crazy and complicated Franny was. "That's because they're people, only smarter. They know us better than we know them, and a lot of them have a sense of humor. They're exactly like us, minus our useless mental power and thumbs." Later that week, Linda called to me from the porch. "You should see this sweet little kitty. She's barely older than a kitten, but she's already a mother." I was catted out. I had no intention of heaving myself to my feet, crossing an entire room, and poking my nose into the porch to look at a cat that didn't belong to us. Pastor Larry from Linda's church had phoned with an odd request. He'd driven 21 miles from Ionia to see a movie with his son and daughter-in-law, Nicole, who fostered cats. before enjoying Buck Benny Rides Again, Steamboat Bill Jr., or whatever it was that was playing, they had planned on dropping off a mother cat and her kittens for shots at the vet down the street. But Dr. LeBlanc put the youngsters on his scale and determined that they didn't weigh enough yet to get poked with needles. So Pastor Larry asked Linda if we could take the cats for a couple of hours while they watched Song of the Thin Man, My Man Godfrey, or possibly Bringing Up Baby. I don't like the idea of them sitting in the carrier the whole time, Linda told me, but we're not supposed to let them out. They haven't been tested for anything. I'm not looking at them, I said. She trotted back to the porch to check on the cats and returned to continue a running commentary about how precious they were. The mother keeps looking at me with the most appealing expression. She has this peaceful and gentle demeanor. Come see her. She's just the picture of feminine grace and tenderness. I'm in a really good part of this book, and I don't want to put it down right now, I said. These weren't simply adorable cats, of course. These were adorable cats in need of a home. I recognized the danger of getting anywhere too close to them. While Linda had already been contaminated by their cuteness, I could still keep my distance so that at least one of us didn't catch the adoption bug. Unfortunately, the disorder was extremely contagious. As Linda went on and on about how nice an influence a sweet, calm cat could be on Maynard, I caught myself saying, maybe if he had a friend, he wouldn't be so needy. It had come out of me like a sneeze before I could stop it. I trudged out to take a gander at the cat that I had apparently just agreed to take. As I reached into the carrier and petted the white and caramel-colored cat, I wasn't thinking about Maynard, who had been howling since I abandoned him, and my book Franny came to mind. She couldn't have been more different from the contented and self-assured mother. As the youngster huddled with her kittens calm as a blade of grass, our alfalfa girl patrolled the backyard, terrorizing the local wildlife. Is that even the same cat? I asked Linda a few weeks later as I slammed and locked the porch door behind me. That can't be the peaceful little mother cat. She's about as peaceful as the Hardy Boys. The white and caramel-colored cat seemed much tinier to me now, a kitten who had given birth to kittens, and her personality had undergone a shocking change. Nicole had kept her for 3 weeks while weaning the babies, then another 2 weeks treating her with the antibiotics to kill some internal bug. I theorized that the drug must have flipped the poles of the magnetic charged particles orbiting her chromosomes that were responsible for her previous calm demeanor. Linda had a more prosaic explanation. Her former placidity was a hormone-induced state that had kept her attentive to her kittens. Once she stopped nursing the babies, she reverted to a maniac. I'm not letting her inside. Franny won't mind losing a porch for a little while, I said without consulting Franny. The kitten's enormous energy reserves fueled a darting shyness that sent her flying beneath the mound of jackets that disguised our coat rack. Our interactions with her consisted of equal parts examining whatever object she had just knocked off a shelf and cajoling her to approach us. It's okay, I told her in response to the latest teeth-jarring crash. Linda didn't need a photo printer anyway. If I kept up the reassuring chatter from a bench on the opposite end of the porch, she eventually jackrabbited over to absorb a volley of petting before retreating to her hidey hole to plan the next destruction for a bit of time. Once we removed everything of value from the porch, except the exercise bike, she occupied her time carving her initials into the front door. Her name had come to me at once. Teeny weeny Tina's up to no good again, I told Linda. Did you just think that up? You must have heard me call her Tina this morning. I shook my head. Tina Louise, Ginger on Gilligan's Island? She's kind of a ginger color and way too cute for her own good. That cuteness compensated for a wealth of naughtiness. I hated to admit it, but I no longer considered Franny to be the most irresistible kitty in the world. pudgy Tina with her searchlight eyes, lopsided slit of a questioning mouth, and a tail that she carried straight up and crooked forward, periscope style, was so addictively adorable that I couldn't keep my hands off of her, and that led to problems with Franny. Lucy, Franny, and Maynard were all nervous when they first came into the house, so I stuck close to Tina as I opened the door. But instead of proceeding cautiously, she immediately made the worst decision possible. I bounded behind her as she shot upstairs into Agnes's territory. A rising growl from across the room stopped her at her landing. Before I could rescue her, Agnes launched a ferocious, snarling charge that brought her to within an inch of Tina. But Tina didn't even flinch. She stood her ground, stretching her neck to get a good whiff of the fire and brimstone hissing from Agnes's throat. Still growling, Agnes backed away. She turned on the kitty heels and skulked off under the bed, trying to figure out what had just happened. I wanted to join her. After living with Mubi for so long, I'd developed a high tolerance for pestering. With two rabbits, two parrots in the house, I had developed some immunity to chaos. But Tina created a new flavor of disruption. She needed to watch everything, and we needed to watch her constantly to keep her from laying waste to everything we owned. We had recently gotten rid of our entertainment center, replacing it with a squatty cabinet that held our new flat-screen television. The baby shoe at the base that supported the TV didn't inspire confidence, but in the earthquake-free zone where we lived, it seemed stable enough. We weren't located in a Tina free zone, however. I was keeping an eye on a Sherlock Holmes movie and the other eye on Tina when she jumped up onto the cabinet and stalked back and forth between the TV and the wall. Our TV wobbled and shuddered as she nudged it, providing a nail-biting suspense that Dressed to Kill lacked. No sooner had I shooed her off than I heard outraged squawks from a parakeet. That was Harvey. I found Tina crouched beneath Bella's cage, deciding which bird to target next. She couldn't do much damage beyond scaring them, but I worried that if she got too close to Dusty, she'd get her nose nipped through the bars. Remarkably, our other cats ignored our birds. Franny seemed to understand that birds were under our protection and pretended that they didn't exist. Mubi and Lucy were too fixated on packaged food to look for it on the wing. Maynard only wanted to be petted, and Agnes spent her time cultivating grudges. But once Tina discovered our easily spooked parakeets, she became obsessed. She quickly learned to exploit the weakness of the door that safeguarded our birds, but technically we didn't have one. Connecting the front of the house to the kitchen dining room where the birds lived was a short passageway that contained the door to the basement. The passageway was so narrow that when you opened the basement door too far, it bumped the opposite wall. We had learned to use this design flaw to our advantage by forcing the basement door open enough that it jammed against the plasterboard and blocked the passageway. The system had worked fine, but it was darned inconvenient. Closing the basement door could mean three things in our house. It could mean closing the door to close off the basement or opening the door to close off the bird room. And it could also mean shutting a completely separate door in the basement that led out to our backyard. Woe unto us if our lives ever depended upon acutely and accurately executing the command, "Quick, close the basement door." We would just stand there and perish. Tina constantly tested the door to see how firmly it was wedged against the wall. If I had closed off the passageway via a half-hearted shove of the door, a few thumps would open it. If the door was seated too tightly for her to budge, she'd wait for someone to open it and then dart through. We did our best to keep her occupied with other things besides birds. Linda found a dust-covered toy mouse under the dresser, rinsed it off, tossed it to Tina. She batted it around until it disappeared, then resumed her vigil outside the bird room. I bought another mouse at the store up the street, and it pulled a vanishing act within a few hours, too. Back at the store, I discovered that a sympathetic manufacturer sold fuzzy mice in packs of 12. "Get that, mousie," Linda would cry, breaking one out of the package and heaving it against the wall. After springing for a few more 12-packs, we learned why our bookcase had started listing to the right. Tina had packed the small space beneath it full of tiny toy mice. The attention that we lavished on the new kid wasn't lost on Franny. She all but abandoned the living room for the basement. In spite of my attempts to shower her with extra attention, she even refused to let me pet her at her feed dish. Outdoors to pay me back, she doubled down on her bird hunting, forcing me to set up another loop of fencing in order to save the bird bath from being bullseyed. One afternoon, she alarmed me by tussling with a squirrel beneath the pine tree. Mr. Nutkin emerged unharmed from the opposite side, leaped to the top of the pump house, and shimmied up the hackberry tree. Franny lingered under the boughs. Before dark, she limped inside and hid behind the bed. "Is your leg okay?" I asked her. My solicitations had the predictable result of urging her to hobble deeper into the shadows. The next morning, Agnes, Mooby, Lucy, and Maynard, and Tina each received a dollop of canned cat food, while I spoiled Franny with a minced portion of the greasiest chicken dark meat I could find. She wouldn't even raise her chin to glance at it. Later, she limped past the food to use the porch litter box, ignored my enthusiastic praises as she bobbled by me, and concealed herself behind the headboard. Lucy tried to reach Franny's chicken, but Tina scrabbled over her and scarfed up the food. A suddenly animated Franny rose up on all fours and hissed. "She seems to be in a lot of pain," I said. "I'd better take her to the vet." "Give her a day," said Linda. "We gave her two when she broke the world's record for sleeping in one position without moving formally. Held by Mooby, I made an appointment with Dr. Post. The trick was laying our hands on her, since she would only leave the space behind our headboard to nibble at her kibble or use the litter box in the dead of night. I managed to wiggle between the wall and the side of the bed, but I couldn't reach her. At the other end of the headboard sat a small bookcase. The plan was to sit Linda in its place and have her shoo Franny in my direction. When I started to twist and slide the bookcase away, Franny trotted out to the porch. I grabbed the squeaking cat and inserted her into a pet carrier, one toenail at a time. "Let's put her on the floor and see how she walks," Dr. Post said. To my amazement, Franny trotted around the examination room without a hint of a limp. "It wasn't bothering her not even an hour ago," I told her. She picked herself up, set her on an examination table, and felt the leg. "I'm not finding any injury consistent with a squirrel bite," she said. "There's no sign of a break. She could have a soft tissue injury. She acts like it's serious. How is Franny getting along with the new one?" "She's not. Tina's the anti-Franny. She's playful, fearless, very outgoing, and she seems happy all the time. Franny's an extremely serious cat." "And have you been paying a lot of attention to Tina lately?" Franny sprang down to the table to emphasize her dislike of any mention of the name Tina. "Do you think she's faking an injury to get attention?" "I've heard of dogs doing that," said Dr. Post. "I haven't seen it in a cat, but you don't want to put it past them. I wouldn't underestimate her ability to get what she wants." While I was picking up my jaw from the floor, Dr. Post's examination room, Linda was balanced on the edge of the bed, folding laundry. Most of the load consisted of pathetically tattered washcloths with all of the color beaten out of them, and after endless hours of birdcage scrubbing and linoleum mopping. Humming a soul-fortifying hymn, Linda had just finished stacking the washcloths into three soft towers, rising from the middle of the mattress when Tina bounded up and crashed them, like a child jumping into a pile of autumn leaves. "That's very naughty," Linda said, but the toppling laundry frightened her, and she had already fled to the room. Linda tracked her down on the porch. "Did you understand what I said?" The crooked mouth, wide-eyed stare, indicated that the tyke did not and would not take a hint. "People don't need to play with you 24 hours a day." To underscore the gravity of the situation, Linda added, "Here, go get your mousey. Go get that mousey now." When Linda moseyed back into the bedroom to finish the folding, Maynard was sprawled across the divan he had made from the spilled stacks of laundry, looking for all the world like the king of Kathmandu. I popped in with Franny, who ran behind the bed and held on as soon as I opened her carrier. An unchased and turbocharged Tina jumped up onto the bed for another round of wrecking ball. Discovering Maynard on top of the rubble, she recognized a comrade in arms and plopped down beside him. Seeing them together brought to mind a favorite saying of Linda's, "What one doesn't think of, the other does." And it didn't take Tina long to come up with another bright idea. She had already stolen the house out from under Franny's feet. Now it was time to grab the outdoors, too. Next week, we're going to find out how Tina grabbed the outdoors in Bob Tarte's Kitty Cornered, how Franny and five other incorrigible cats seized control of our house and made it their home. Our next reading comes from ASPCA Action, the official magazine of the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Issue 1, 2026. Change Everything, Stories from the Rescue Effect. Each year, millions of animals enter shelters. Shelters are full, and their teams work tirelessly to provide dogs and cats of all ages, sizes, and wonderful personalities a home. As the nation's leading animal welfare organization, the ASPCA is uniquely equipped to unite the sheltering community. In 2025, its second year, the Rescue Effect brought together more than 600 shelters and rescues across 43 states to raise awareness about life-saving power of pet adoption. 116 of these organizations received ASPCA's grant funding as part of a $2 million investment that supported shelter operations and fee-waived adoption events from August through October. With nearly 6 million dogs and cats entering the United States shelters annually, the Rescue Effect empowers adopters to make a difference, not only for the pet they welcome home, but for the many others who gain a better chance at finding families of their own. Through adoption, fostering, and advocacy, this movement proves that when we help one animal, we also help many more. The third time's the charm. 7-year-old Dozer didn't have the easiest road to adoption. He'd been adopted but then returned, due to no fault of his own, to Providence Animal Rescue League in Rhode Island, where he remained for several months. Like many dogs with herding instincts, Dozer took his job seriously and sometimes struggled with overexcitement and boredom, said Shane Muir from PARL, which is Providence Animal Rescue League. Nikki and Jeremy had recently moved into a new home and wanted a canine companion to share it. Nikki spotted Dozer at Parle's website, and from the moment they brought him home, it was clear he was meant to be part of their family. Giving a dog a second chance, or in Dozer's case, a third chance, at loving homes is the best way to go, Nikki said. There are so many nice, adoptable animals who are waiting for special persons. We are so happy to have Dozer in our lives. Dozer's departure was one of many Parle celebrated during the Rescue Effect. Each animal adopted during the campaign freed up space for Parle to have other animals in need. Participating in the campaign has helped raise awareness of overcrowding in shelters and the ripple that every foster or adoption creates, said Shane. While weekends are generally successful for us in terms of adoption, these numbers were significantly higher in comparison. Dozer's story shows how every adoption creates space and hope for the next animal. Thanks to Rescue Effect, more pets like Dozer are finding their people. Full house, full hearts. Eliza's family has always made room for animals. With Otto, their fourth adoption from Texas Humane Heroes, their hearts are fuller than ever. Otto, a senior cat who has spent months waiting at the shelter, caught Eliza's eye when he gently pawed at the glass as she walked by. Though staff described him as shy, Otto's curiosity led him to approach Eliza. She knew then and there she wanted to adopt him. Since going home, Otto's personality has blossomed. He's a joy to come home to, said Eliza. I gave him plenty of space at first, and now he sleeps in my bed and is super chatty. His favorite thing to do is look out my window.
Eliza knows firsthand the effect adoption has on animals and people. I encourage adoption because these animals are so loving. A lot of them have had a rough time, so they really appreciate a good home. Adoption also lets shelters and rescues make space and use their resources to help other animals. Otto's adoption is just one example of how small moments like a paw on a glass can lead to a life-changing connection. The rescue effect helps shelters like Texas Humane Heroes make adoption more accessible to anyone who's ready to open their hearts when they're experiencing the need to adopt, like Eliza's family, or even first-timers. Sometimes the adoption fee is the barrier that keeps a family from welcoming a new pet, says Jane Wisnant from Texas Humane Heroes. Thanks to this campaign, we were able to provide the support and the need for families that could still give an animal a loving home but lacked the funds in order to carry through on the adoption. Every single adoption represents a happy ending and a new beginning. Each rescue creates space, hope, and momentum for other animals. That's the heart of the rescue effect, a movement powered by compassion, where one act of kindness leads to many more. Whether you choose to adopt, foster, volunteer, or donate, or simply share these stories, your support helps shelter save lives and give more animals the chance to find their perfect match. This is just the start. Stay tuned for the Rescue Effects 2026 campaign. This article, Adoption 1, Change Everything, Stories from the Rescue Effect, was printed by the ASPCA Action Magazine, the official magazine of the ASPCA Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Issue 1, 2026. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the stories, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories on Animal Companions. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.